In the first episode that you recorded with Nick Campbell, one of the things that he talks about is work flexibility, people working from home or working from shared space, and people kind of setting their own hours. I've heard a lot about this like over the past couple of years, but I feel like it's something that's only been sort of like experimented with here and there. And Nick seems to be pretty successful with it. I was wondering what your opinion about it was, but I also want to preface before I say this, like for me personally, I've always been interested in this, being able to either work from home or kind of set your own schedule. But what I've noticed about myself is that like structure for me is a big thing. So it makes it easier for me to work when like I know I have to be at work at a certain time and the work ends at a certain time. And being around other people who I'm working with also helps me. So, you know, with me coming from that place, I'm wondering what your opinion on that is.
I'm going to try to answer that question in parts, I think. Speaking just for myself and being very selfish about it, I really do enjoy working from home. The reason why is because I can be comfortable in my pajamas or sweatpants, and my home is the most comfortable place that I have currently, and everything is set up exactly the way I want, and I can get a lot more work done because I'm not compelled to go and say talk to you about an edit or follow up or give somebody else some direction or something like that, and I'm constantly being interrupted all day long. And that's just part of being a manager, that people, your teams, need direction and they need feedback so they can continue moving forward. And when I'm at home, none of that happens, and I'm not tempted to go, because it's impossible to walk down the hallway and tell Jamie, hey, good job on this, and I need this done by Thursday or whatever it is. So I can get a lot done and I feel more productive at home. But then I also realize then I am not talking to people and I'm not providing any kind of direction or clarity on things, and the best that I can do probably is just fire off an email and say, here's what I'm thinking. And so then I see that that could be a detriment. Now, I know people who work at home and they start to get walled in and they become somewhat antisocial and they forget how to interact with other human beings. Jim Rohn is famous for saying, you are who you spend the most time with. So if you want to know who you are, average the five people that you spend the most time with. Look at their income, look at their life goals, look at their family and their happiness. You are the average of those five things. So when you're by yourself, well, what are your average five going to look like? Probably going to be a pet, maybe your spouse, your kids. And so you start to think and operate differently. You know, I noticed that sometimes my wife, because she spends almost all of her day with the kids, she has to adopt to their language and speak to them a certain way. And sometimes she has to remind them several times. And then I come home and she's using the same operating system to talk to me. And I'm like, whoa, I just came from the professional world and now I have to. So we're both coming from two different worlds and we need to like meet in the middle. I need to look at her not as an employee or a manager of the house, but as my wife, the mother to my children. And then she needs to look at me not like as a overgrown boy, and as her husband and the breadwinner.
Yeah.
So I can see that having its pros and cons. Now, would blind or the future work better if we're all worked remotely? Well, let's talk about a little bit of that. I think there are definite cost advantages because you get to live in a place that's probably beautiful, something that you can afford, where the cost of living is much lower. So your quality of life is much higher. But then I just miss the collaboration aspect. Like, when we sit down and we look at something like right there, that's the frame, or that's brilliant, and or the accidental discovery when you pass by somebody's screen, or they were looking at something else for another project even, and I've had this reaction too, like, that's really cool, can you send me that link because I'm working on something else over here. I couldn't have given that person direction to find that because I wasn't looking for that. Mm-hmm. So is there a hybrid model? I don't know. But I also noticed that when Nick was working on his videos, he was shooting it, he was editing it. So as good as that might be, it's never going to get to that multi-camera switching level. He's got all the support and somebody's cutting in B-roll and doing all these, because that takes a lot of work.
Yeah.
So right now I assume he's doing all the production himself. And you can see here in our studio with the cameras and the lights. And if I have an idea to try something, the guys figure it out and we do a test. And it either looks good or it doesn't, or it works or it doesn't. And we try other things. Or here's something that I really do cherish, Stuart. When we finish an episode or a segment, we go to lunch together. Not all of us and not all the time, but we do. And then we riff on each other. This is like the jam, right? The band is jamming.
Yeah.
And it's like off the clock, if you will. So one of the ideas that we had in the car was, they're like, Chris, we could see you getting angry on the call because people were doing that. I think we should just do a whole segment where you just cut them off. Like, they're dead to you. Like, ask your question. You're on the air with Chris. And if you don't ask the question correctly, I'm just going to hang up on you and say next. And then they would play like a little buzzer sound. And I thought it was like really mean-spirited.
So you're like a Gordon Ramsay kind of character where you're just like, done.
Donkey, what are you saying? You know, whatever it is. And then just, this is garbage. So maybe that wouldn't have happened for those chance encounters. And I love that. And I think you like structure. And I also just like seeing you just as a human being. Like, hey, it's nice to see you today. And I don't know if there's even a creative thing that I can equate to that, but it's just to connect. I think humans are social creatures. So if you work at home, where are you going to get that kind of interaction? How are you going to be inspired? Greg, Matthew, Ben, they do things that inspire me. Nothing to do with what I'm doing, but it's like, okay, it's cool.
So the next topic that I wanted to hit with you was, Nick talks a lot about how when he was sort of first starting up as a designer, he was working places and he was getting a lot of constructive feedback on his work from supervisors, from people that are working with him, et cetera, et cetera. And I just wanted to talk about growth via feedback, why feedback is important, why instructors are important, basically like why a person should submit the work that they're doing to others and accept in return feedback to help them grow.
Nick was really smart about this, and he knew what he didn't know. And so he was seeking mentorship. And if you think about it, a mentor is a person who shares their point of view, how they make decisions in the world, and what they're looking for. Some are better at it than others, and the ones that are great are teachers to the world. So if I can inhabit your mind for a little bit, if I can glean a little bit of your knowledge, well, it looks a lot like feedback. So Dr. Holtzman, who's the faculty development person at Art Center, when I sit down, basically his job is to help teachers teach better. He's into pedagogy, which is the study of education, I believe. And he said that, Chris, what you're trying to do is you're trying to break down what you're looking for when you look at work. So he would ask me something like this. He's like, when you're critiquing a piece, what are the five things you're looking at and making a decision on? And that question caught me off guard, because usually a piece comes up, all the, what is that, synaptic nerves fire off, and I'm going into some kind of automatic mode where I'm just talking and just reacting. So when he said that, it took me a moment to kind of figure it out. I said, okay, well, I'm first looking for clarity. Can I see the frames? Do they make sense? Is it too complicated? Okay, so now it's clear. I have to say, well, it's clear, but is it interesting or is it boring? So I'm looking for something that is interesting or dramatic. You can have something very clear and it'll be very boring. And next I'm asking myself, do the moments that add up in a sequence, do they reveal a bigger whole? Is there something much bigger than the frames that we just see? So it's clear, it's dramatic. So let's just say that's an action film. Dramatic action, there's fight sequences, explosions, but adding all the parts up don't lead to a bigger whole. It's not revealing a bigger truth or something like that. And we will go on and on. So then I broke it down to these five things. So a good mentor, now I don't want to say that everybody that gives feedback is good, because people who give feedback and say, oh, this work is average, or I expected more from you, that is feedback. That is telling you that it's not hitting a certain standard, but it doesn't give you a path towards how to make it better. You're not gaining any more insight to making it better than you did prior to that person saying that. So one of my rules from teaching all the years that I've been teaching, I guess about 15 years or so now, is I never make a comment to attack the person. I will talk about the work, and by virtue or extension of me talking about the work, you may feel attacked, and I will go hard on the work, but I'm not sitting there attacking you. Unless you make it about you, and then we will have a conversation about that. And I'm a really straight shooter, so if a kid comes up and says, you know, I did this and I did that, and this is what I came up with. And it looks like total BS to me, where that looks like 10 minutes worth of work. So something is not adding up for me. And now I have to ask you, and now we get into issues of integrity. If you told me I put 5 minutes worth of work into it, I leave it like that. But then I have this thing about honesty, right? So let's just be real with each other. It took you 10 hours to produce that work. Can you show me the iterative steps? Did you build this model? Like, did you build it backwards with one eye closed? Like, how could it take you that long? You know, you're either inept or you're not telling me the truth. But I'm digressing here, because that's the only time I would actually, because if students are listening to us, what a liar, he went after me, right? And maybe I did. Maybe I'm just a liar. I don't know. You want to say something, though.
You were making examples of people giving sort of like generic feedback, and that just reminded me of last night when Danny was talking about the fact that, like, if somebody ever tells you, you know, it just didn't do anything for me or something like that, he was like, get as far away from those people as you possibly can.
He talked about clients who give feedback, like, I'll know it when I see it.
That doesn't help me at all. Yeah.
When you hear that, I'll know it when I see it, you got to just run. A client, a supervisor, a boss, somebody's like, make it fresh, make it rad, make it dope. That's a person being really lazy and inarticulate. And if you're going to take on the responsibility of being a manager and art director, you better know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the worst kind of being subjective, basically.
Yeah. It's just like, I like it, I don't like it, cool, not cool. It doesn't really help me. So now that we've parsed that down a little bit to say that there's different kinds of feedback, we'll group a whole bunch of kinds of feedback into doesn't provide direction, it attacks me personally. None of that stuff is good. That stuff is toxic. All it does is it makes a person start to second guess themselves and become really insecure. And I've watched other creative directors do this. And what happens is the person comes in full of confidence. They know what they're doing, and they leave a shell of who they were. And it's totally heartbreaking to see that, because they even question, like, does the sun come up in the east? You know?
Yeah.
Does the earth orbit around the sun? Like, they just don't know up from down anymore. And I have to now think parts of, like, psyops, psychological operations, I think, they probably do these kinds of experiments on you to brainwash you. So then you're programmed to take in new information that's not true. Mm-hmm. And that's a horrible thing to do to a human being, especially in a non-competitive role. Like, we're working in the creative industry. Why would you do that? You are going to destroy somebody's psyche.
Well, let me ask you something. I was, as we were talking about this, I was thinking about, you know, being in school, and as a student, I'm going to kind of take this away from design for a second and put it towards film, because that's my background. One of the issues that I had getting feedback on scripts that I was writing in school was, a lot of times fellow students or teachers had a very different idea of what they found interesting or what they found exciting. And so, you know, I might submit a script to a teacher who, you know, really likes X, Y, and Z, and I'm more going for an ABC kind of feel. So in situations like that, how much of that feedback should you take to heart? How much of that feedback should a person work on? Obviously, if it's a client, you have to take 100% feedback and you have to bend that towards them. But just from a personal perspective, if you're looking for feedback from somebody and they're not really on the same wavelength, should you take that to heart and change what you're doing, or keep going with where you're going?
So two parts. Let's talk about client feedback first. And I want to provide some clarity on this. We need to understand something. When a client pays you to do something, you have an obligation to do what it is that they need you to do. And we understand that. That's what you're talking about. But I also don't necessarily feel that it's also in serving them that they prescribe to you what to do. That's like the client who prescribes his own medicine. And we don't want to do that. Or self-diagnose.
Self-diagnose.
So they're self-diagnosing, and then they're also prescribing what to do. Okay? So this is where you, as an intelligent and smart creative, can sit there and talk to your client and listen to them and try to understand their ultimate concern. And then devise a meaningful solution to solve that. So don't ignore the ultimate concern. But sometimes a client, and this is a very typical thing, they'll say, make the logo bigger. That's the typical one. Everybody's going to groan, right? Make the logo bigger. God, it's already big. What they're really saying is, I have a hard time reading it. So if some client says to me, make the logo bigger, I would say something like this. Okay, great. We'll make it bigger. But I'm curious as to why you're saying that. They're like, well, I just can't read it. I say, oh, I see that. Okay, so by my eye, what I see is potentially there's issues of contrast, of complexity, and maybe even an issue of scale, as you suggest. Are you open to me exploring a few options that might solve that problem without necessarily making it bigger? Well, you know, I don't know, but okay, sure. I change the color, I reduce the background, I blur some things out, change the contrast, put it in front of the client again, like, oh, so much better. And that's what I'm talking about. Like, I'm 100% listening to your ultimate goal, but not necessarily doing what it is that you think I should do. So I'm not following your prescription. I'm going to try a couple things, but I ask for permission. And sometimes when I wholeheartedly disagree with a client, I'll say something like this. At the end of the day, there's no confusion in my mind who gets the final say. It's you. And I will do exactly what you want me to do. But I feel beholden to you to tell you, I think this direction is inferior by a multitude of three to the other direction. And here's why. What would you like to do? And that's all I can do.
Yeah.
Okay? I'm not going to argue with them. I'm not going to try to persuade them beyond that. I'm just going to lay it like that. And once people can hear from you that you're going to do what they want and they've been heard, that's important. They're now open to hearing other ideas. If you do it like that, you have a much stronger probability of it working out. And I have a pretty high probability of being able to, quote unquote, convince the client of taking my route versus theirs.
You know what I find interesting about this is what I've been hearing a lot, because I've been working on a lot of other conversations that similar things like this have been coming up in lately, is ask questions, you know, get to the root of the problem. And it's interesting because I feel like I'm definitely guilty of this. And I feel like a lot of young creative people and just starting out creative people are definitely guilty of this as well. It's like, we think that we shouldn't ask questions, because if we ask questions, we might look like we don't know what we're doing, or we might look like we're trying to thwart what the client wants, or there's like this list of reasons, this short list of things that, like, you know, if we ask questions, it's going to come off as negative, you know? So the biggest thing that I'm learning from you right now is, that's absolutely not true. Like,
it's the opposite.
Yeah.
You think if I ask a question, I'm dumb. Like, if you use a word I don't understand, maybe it's like alacrity. And alacrity means cheerful eagerness. So if I tell my boys, like, when you take out the trash, I want you to do it with a degree of alacrity. They're like, what, Dad? I don't want you to be like dragging your feet. But if you sat in a room and somebody says alacrity and you don't know what it means, you're going to be the idiot if you don't raise your hand. It's like, I don't know what it means. Can somebody help? So really smart people, in my opinion, are listen more than they speak, ask more questions than they give advice. And I like to be perceived as smart, but I'm not really concerned about it. I'm just going to do what feels right to me. And so, yes, you do ask a lot of questions. And there are good questions, there are bad questions. Like if my son, okay, so here's an example of a bad question in case somebody in the audience is listening. Is like, what? Okay. I have my two boys here and they're spending the summer at the office trying to get a taste of what it's like to be at work. And my younger boy, he's 11 years old. He comes in, Dad, can I help you? I'm like, yeah. Hey, buddy, go get me a cup of ice water and some M&Ms. He's like, okay. Comes back, he's like, I don't know where they are. Where are they? I'm like, did you use all of your resources? Did you ask people in the office? Did you try looking in the normal spots before? So he's looking for a prescriptive step-by-step instruction, and that's not a good question. That's just being lazy. That's not showing initiative. The kinds of questions he should have asked is, Dad, as far as I know, there are peanut M&Ms and chocolate M&Ms. Which one do you prefer? And are you one of the types who only eats blue M&Ms? Should I separate them? You know, those are good questions to ask versus where are they? Who do I talk to? What spots should I look in? Those are questions that you can easily resolve some other way. So there's two examples there for you.
Heyo, John Roth here from The Future. I'm here to tell you guys about the Pro Membership. A lot of you have been asking about how you can engage with us and where you can go to meet like-minded individuals. Well, I'm here to tell you how. For $75 a month with the Pro Membership, you can join Chris Doe's collective of creative entrepreneurs, which includes everyone from designers to strategists to writers and more from all over the world. Also included is over 40 hours of exclusive videos on a variety of topics, from the business of design to project management, and access to 2 pro calls a month, where you can have your questions answered by Chris live. All that and more in your Pro Membership for just $75 a month. Not afraid of commitment? Sign up for a year and save $150. The Pro Membership, exclusively in the online store. Go to thefuture.com/shop for more.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Man, you talking about this just kind of made me realize something. I've spent a fair share of the last couple of years being a freelancer, and I'm not sure that I would like to admit that it's laziness, but I feel like there has been a lot of times where I've dealt with clients before and they didn't really know what they wanted, and I probably wasn't asking the right questions to get to what they wanted. And I did finally just relent and say, what is it that you want? Probably not in those terms, but basically just kind of said to them, like, just tell me what you want. As an up-and-comer, how do you learn what questions to ask? What is a good resource to kind of develop those skills in getting down to that core of what the customer or what the client wants? Is it something that you that a mentor brings to you, or is it something that like you can develop on your own, or how do you get to that space?
That's a really great question.
It's experience, obviously.
Experience helps, but there are some shortcuts.
Yeah.
So we're big on life hacking. We're always looking for ways to do something smarter, faster, and work less and do more. That's okay. Something I've learned recently, and when I say recently, in the last few years, is if you ask a person what they're trying to accomplish, what are your goals? What's the objective? What are you trying to do? So in the case of like make it bigger, what are you trying to do? Oh, I need to make it more legible. And then you can ask some why questions, like why don't you think it's legible right now? So when I go out and lecture, I say think like a 5-year-old. And they're like, what? Yeah. I go to bed. Why? Because it's late. Well, why is it late? You know, they just keep asking why. And they'll check you on your stuff. It's because it's arbitrarily determined by me now to go to bed. And don't ask me another question. So start with, what are you trying to do? What's getting in the way? And why do you believe that to be true? Those are my three golden questions that typically when I speak on this about asking better questions, those are your go-to. Okay? Use that. Hope that helps. And another thing, and you can listen to the episode when we talk about communication and being transparent and letting people know what it is you're thinking about, that helps out a lot. Again, that's another skill. And these are the skills that I think are absolutely necessary in the 21st century. The ability to ask great questions, learning how to listen, learning how to be present and transparent with your thoughts, learning how to learn. Maybe the last one's learning how to search. Mm-hmm. That's it. I think K through 12 should be about this over and over and over again. Because the problems of tomorrow, because the solutions to the problems of tomorrow have yet to be invented. So there will be nothing for you to necessarily look up. But if you have some kind of framework, a way of thinking and moving through the world, no matter what is thrown at you, you'll feel really confident because you believe in your tools to solve any kind of problem. That's the definition of confidence, right? When I say, I am confident that you're going to be able to do that task, I'm saying I believe whatever skill sets you have, your way of working, will be able to tackle anything that's thrown at you. So when we say self-confidence, it means that you now have the tools to take on any kind of problem. So I can be thrown into most kinds of meetings and problems and situations that I know nothing about. Yes, I will be disoriented at the beginning. Yes, I will feel a little bit insecure at the beginning. But I know if I just use my process of trying to understand a problem and being transparent about what I know and what I don't know, things will work itself out. And it hasn't failed me. But let me go back to your two-parter. You're going to have to do me a favor. You're going to have to like do one question one at a time, because I have to not only know how to answer, I have to remember the two-part question. So my computing power is like reduced, right? Okay. I think the other part to your question is, well, how do you take in the feedback? Let's just say now it's the good kind of, the positive kind of feedback. Why are you motivated to do this in the first place? Why? So the first thing that you want to think about is this. Separate you from the things that you do. Okay? Detach yourself from you as a human being and the things that you do and make. When you eat a meal and you take the wrappings and you crunch it together, well, that's trash now. When you've made that trash and you've contributed to the landfill. But you as a human being are not trash. You are not part of landfill. But when we craft something, whether it's an object, a film, a motion graphics thing, or a logo, it somehow, for some reason, becomes part of our own identity. It's not. In order for you to listen wholly, you need to be objective about this now. So you need to detach. You need to look at it for what it is. It's now a drawing on a piece of paper made by another person, not you. And you need to listen, and you need to be as critical about that piece of work as you would anything else in your life, right? You notice a lot of people who are quick to give comments and feedback are also like super defensive. Well, when we talk about the symmetry of logic, it's like it was easy for you to give advice and just spew stuff out of your mind. But when somebody else does it to you, you don't like it. So one of those two things needs to change. Stop giving advice or be better at taking advice. Okay, so This will help you be less defensive, because now it's somebody's work and we're going to talk about it. And what you should do then is you should listen for things that you can do, directions it can go in. Okay, needs to be a little bit shorter. This isn't working. And where something is confusing and abstract, you should ask a question about, what do you mean when you say that? One of my students, when I said to the class, that's not a very elegant solution, I was going to walk away from that comment. That's not an elegant solution. Everybody nodded like, yep, it's not an elegant solution. And the smartest student I've ever had said, Chris, I'm not trying to be a troublemaker, but what do you mean when you say elegant? I have a sense of what that means, but I suspect your definition is different than mine and theirs, because I think they thought it was elegant at that time, right? We're not all trying to make ugly things. I said, okay, all right, Mr. Smarty Pants. He caught me. All he had to do is, why do you think, or what? You know, he just asked for clarification, and that's a great tool to use. So I said, okay, when we think of things that are elegant, how would you describe them? We think of things that are clean, that are modern, that are uncomplicated, that seem almost natural versus overworked. So what I did was, on the spot, I created a value graph, XY. On the right is of something very positive. On the left is something the opposite of that. So on one side, it's clear. On the other side, it's confusing. On one side of the spectrum, it's dramatic. On the other side, it's boring. On one side, it might be cliche versus innovative. And we're just looking at the spectrum. So now let's look at each piece of work. And that, and even as we all are very subjective about grading, at least now we have some criteria to look at it, and each one can score it. And that makes it less subjective. So that was him asking me a question that Dr. Holtzman taught me, which was, explain what you're looking for in 3 to 5 points. And that's what I was looking for. That's what I wanted in elegant design. Now, I have to tell you, the reason why I was able to excel quicker than my classmates was when the teacher critted the work, I sat there and looked at it like, whose work is that? Even though I knew it was mine. And if they would tear it apart, I'm like, okay, that's cool, that's right. I would just take the information in and I would just try it. It was very clear in my mind, I'm here to learn something, so what's the point of me being here if the instructor says, do this, this, and that? I'm like, no, that's not going to work. And we've all been that. We've all maybe have witnessed that. And we know, like, what is wrong with that person? Next week, what are you going to do? You're going to repeat the exact same mistakes over and over again. It's like you're living in a virtual groundhog day all your life.
One thing I was wondering is would you say take a little bit of the time that you're using to improve your artwork and instead use that to figure out how to ask the right questions so that you are learning how to better deal with clients at a young age? Because I feel like a lot of people, they go to school, it's all about the work. How does your work look? And they get out of school, they're still in that mindset. So they're always about like, well, what does my stuff look like? Does it look good enough? The client doesn't think that it looks good, but I know that it looks good because I've spent all this time working on it. And a lot of people maybe don't even take into consideration for their first 5 or 10 years of work how to best deal with clients. You know, they stumble over those same things over and over again. So do you feel like it's safe to say when you graduate from college, you need to switch modes and focus a little bit less on how good the work looks and a little bit more on what your client needs from you?
Again, a lot to unpack in your question there, okay? I don't think you should flip modes because you should have been in the right mode to begin with. And that's what you're saying. You're like, there was a student mentality and now there's a professional mentality. You should have had the professional mentality as a student. So there is no, it's all about scaffolding, right? So we're moving up every single day towards becoming the ultimate version of yourself. So let's take it back into school. I think you do need to learn your craft, but I think you should learn why you're doing what it is you're doing. So it's not from a gut instinct anymore. And it's difficult for creative types to think that that's possible. when I tell people, are you offended by the idea of a creative formula or not? And I think sometimes they feel like that's demeaning to their magical witchcraft that they practice, right? They really do. It's like, then you're just saying, like, I'm an automaton, I'm a robot, and I just, would you think that's such a foreign concept? And I said, let me prove it to you. There's this thing called predictive typing. How does the computer know what you're going to type before you know? You type in a few things because it's running some kind of crazy algorithm based on a lot of data points as to what people are searching for when they start typing in these letters. Like, did you mean? How does Google know that? Now, Google does a better job of predicting what it is that you want, more so than a real human being. Like, you can spend all day with me, Stuart, and I'm like, yeah, I'm thinking of that and then it's like, Westin Hotel? I'm like, yes, how did you know that? Right? So I think it's like everything in science reveals that there's logic and order to these seemingly random things. Once what we viewed the world with mysticism and full of awe and wonder, science begins to explain everything. So I think the creative process is one where you can explain and look at it step by step. That makes me, I think, a good student and also a good teacher, because I can see things in those step-by-step things. So when you're trying to make something good visually, that tends to put you in the realm of subjectivity, into taste level. Somebody likes gold, somebody likes silver. Somebody's like, those things are both gaudy. Well, that's very subjective now, and I can't win that war with a client. You can win that war as a student because ultimately the instructor has no power over you except for to give you a grade. And most instructors, I would say, the fair ones, even if they totally disagree with you, if you have a good point of view, they're not going to fail you. But I think first try to understand why something looks good and try to bring a little bit more of the understanding of the science behind it. So when an instructor says to you, that doesn't work for me, you shouldn't go away feeling dejected. First of all, strip the emotion away and say, well, why do you say that? Not as a kind of a flippant response, not as a knee-jerk thing, not as a defensive maneuver, but just one where you truly want to learn. Why? How did you come to that conclusion? I'm curious. They might not be able to articulate it to you, but they'll make an attempt. And do your best to see, like, okay, I don't want to repeat those same mistakes. Now, those same skills will be used when you're out in the real world. Replace the instructor with a client. That's not working for me, client says. Oh, what's driving that statement? I'm curious. I agree, something is off. I felt it too. Oh, because there's this part that's part of the legacy of your brand that we didn't know about that you guys designed in the 1930s, and this reminds you, oh my gosh, I didn't know that. That was not part of the public domain. Mm-hmm. Now that you revealed it. So I can see this. I get it now. So if we did X, Y, and Z more as as a systematic, logical decision of addressing your concern versus subjective, artistic, decorative thing, oh, now we're on the same page again, and now we're good. So it would be good if we could think like that, and I've been able to adopt that, and it just was like smooth transition straight into working with clients. Okay? So in school, you pay a lot of money to learn as much as possible, but at the end of the day, you are your own master. Nobody's holding a gun to your head. If you don't want to use Helvetica, don't use it. That's fine. Okay? And then in the real world, there is sort of a gun to your head now, a figurative one, where you're not going to be in business long if you keep fighting your clients and you make the experience painful. Somebody, my business coach would say to me, you're not that good to have an attitude. Okay? So Kier would say that. So that meant you don't have that kind of God-given 1% of the earth talent that people will bend to you, and the rest of us just have to work hard and develop great relationships with our clients and deliver a really incredible experience. That's what matters. I have a little tip here. If you're an instructor, if if you're a teacher, a mentor or something, and you're working with a bunch of students, I've tried something that I saw the fashion department at Otis do, and I thought was really cool. So when a person is designing a garment and they're having a critique about it, they pair up. So two students get the critique, not just one. And it's pretty interesting how it works. So you have a partner and you switch when it's your work or when it's somebody else's work, your partner's. So the person, in terms of what I was able to perceive and adapt, was your only job was to listen. Just listen. You don't respond. And your partner, whose work is not involved in this at all, is taking notes based on the feedback that you got. And the experiment that I did with my students was, then I would say to the student who got the feedback, what'd you hear? What are the next steps we need to do? And it's pretty interesting to compare the differences between the objective note taker and the person who's invested in the work, and to see the differences between the two.
Yeah.
It's almost like you can see how quickly this person is going to grow depending on how accurately and how many things they're able to recall based on what the note taker took. So I thought that was great because it took you away from having to do both. Like, you can just sit there and listen and not worry, like, am I recording the notes? So if something wasn't clear, you could ask. And the person who's taking the notes, they didn't have a horse in the race, and so they didn't care what was being said. They just wanted to faithfully write down the action items afterwards. And I thought that was a pretty cool thing to do, and so I borrowed that for my class.
Yeah.
So maybe that'll help the instructors out there that are listening to our podcast. Hey, everybody, thanks for tuning in. I'm Chris.
I'm Stuart.
Next week, I just want to remind you guys that part two, the Nick Campbell podcast, is coming out, so stay tuned. The Future is hosted by me, Chris Doe. The show is edited by Stuart Schuster. Big thanks to Adam Sanborn, who composed our theme song. To subscribe to The Future podcast, check us out on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and now SoundCloud. Make sure you rate and review our episodes. Don't miss out on upcoming events, live streams, workshops, and announcements by going to thefuture.com and sign up for the newsletter link at the bottom. You can also find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at The Future Is Here. Thanks for listening. That's it for this episode. See you in the future.